Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Michael Scheuer, who was formerly known as Anonymous. He's a 22-year veteran of the CIA, an analyst who headed up, he was the chief of the Bin Laden unit at the CIA from 1995 to 1999. He's the author, under the title Anonymous, of a book, Imperial Hubris, and previously Through Our Enemy's Eyes, which is being republished. So we'll be talking to him on the fourth anniversary of 9/11. Since he was the chief Bin Laden hunter prior to 9/11, he has a lot to bring to the table. We'll also talk with the author of the cover article in today's Sunday New York Times magazine, Is He Winning? Taking Stock of the Forever War, with a picture of Bin Laden on the cover. We'll be talking with Mark Danner in the second half of the first hour, and he's a professor of journalism and politics at the University of California, Berkeley, and Bard College, and the author most recently of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. I'm speaking with Michael Scheuer, formerly known as Anonymous. He's a 22-year CIA veteran analyst. He was the chief of the Bin Laden unit from 1995 to 1999. And, Michael, given that Bin Laden is still on the loose, and it's 4 years since 9/11, and prior to that, of course, he was responsible for a series of attacks. It was as though there was a serial killer loose in a geopolitical sense, and we are on a slow learning curve. What's your personal feelings about the obvious fact that he's still around, and even though the president keeps saying we're making progress in the war on terror, do you see any progress?
I certainly think we've had some progress, but it's primarily in terms of a body count, Mr. Masters. We've taken out a lot of al-Qaeda's leadership that was there on 9/11, but al-Qaeda is extremely good at replacing leaders. They train to do that. They spend a lot of time on succession. So when the president says we've reduced the al-Qaeda leadership by two-thirds, you know, it's true, but it's irrelevant because people have been replaced. Otherwise, I think our progress has been very minimal. We're locked into the war in Iraq, which is draining resources and really creating enemies faster than we can kill them.
Well, it is almost describing the situation in Saudi Arabia, because every time they capture, they keep talking about high-value al-Qaeda targets, the head of al-Qaeda. Every other week, it seems that they capture the head of al-Qaeda. So is this a kind of organization that basically replaces itself?
It's very much. It replicates itself very well. One of the problems we still have, Mr. Masters, is we refer to al-Qaeda as a terrorist group, and really it's much closer to an insurgent group modeled on those groups that fought the Soviets in Afghanistan in the 80s. And so they're always expecting to fight a much more powerful enemy. And as I said, they put tremendous amounts of time and effort into planning for succession. And I think you're right. I think Saudi Arabia is a perfect example. They've killed supposedly now 9 or 10 deputies or chiefs of the organization on the Arabian Peninsula, and yet the attacks go on.
Well, it also leads you to ask the main question here, Mike Scheuer, and that is Saudi Arabia and Pakistan are the key countries in the war on terror. They are our key allies. At the same time, they appear to be almost hanging by a thread, and they don't seem to be getting the full weight of our attention as a country because of Iraq. So what would your critique be of our relationship with both Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, given that both of these are key to any success in President Bush's war on terror?
I think, sir, Pakistan is a situation where Musharraf has given us far more assistance than anyone had a right to expect. All of the major al-Qaeda leaders who have been captured in Pakistani cities, for example, have been captured with the assistance of the Pakistani security services. The Pakistanis, under Musharraf, for the first time in the history of their country, sent their conventional forces into the tribal areas of Pakistan and really came very close to igniting a civil war in Pakistan. In addition, they've suffered far more casualties fighting al-Qaeda since 9/11 than we have suffered in Afghanistan. So I think at times politicians in the West or in the United States have a hard time recognizing the problems of other politicians. As you said, Pakistan is the key to our counterterrorism policy, and Musharraf is just about one step ahead of the train. So I think we should probably think about doing more of our own effort than to depend on the Pakistanis.
So we've outsourced to Musharraf, but Musharraf is a military leader in a country that's had a dysfunctional democracy, albeit almost a feudal kind of democracy. Is there any should there be some attention to trying to restore some democracy as a hedge against the Islamists? Because you either have democracy or theocracy in that part of the world.
Well, that's probably true, Mr. Masters, but we've seen in the history of Pakistan that when we have a democracy of some sort, whether it was under the first Bhutto or the second, for example, what they do is basically empty the treasury, drive the country into the ground to the point where the military takes over.
So it becomes a kleptocracy.
Yes, very much so. And I'm not sure what democracy would, you know, a Western-style democracy certainly doesn't have much of a chance in Pakistan, And if we try to restore the kleptocracy again and just create a future situation where the military takes over, you know, the military itself is an increasingly Islamicized organization in Pakistan. And after Musharraf, the pro-Western sentiments of the Pakistani General Officer Corps are not very strong. So I think we're looking at a situation where time is not on our side. And the goal should be, I think, to get bin Laden, Zawahiri, and then get out. But we seem to be there for a much longer term than is going to be beneficial to either Afghanistan or Pakistan.
And I understand that the Punjabi Officer Corps in Pakistan, which is the Pakistani military, are, and you mentioned they're becoming more Islamicized. It's also true, is it not, that the extent to which they used terrorism as a cheap way to fight the Indians in Kashmir has blown up in their face? They're, aren't they experiencing the kind of blowback that, in effect, we're experiencing?
Well, they have some problems with that, yes, sir. They kind of turn the pressure on and off against Indians in Kashmir, rather. They do have a problem. The Pakistanis kind of have a history in their military of intelligence services of thinking they have the lion on a leash, and they end up riding the lion instead. But another big problem that the Pakistanis have at the moment is the developing close relationship between Hamid Karzai's government and the Indians, which Washington is encouraging. And, of course, within the Pakistani General Officer Corps, they immediately become aware of that and believe that the Indians are trying to threaten them on the western border instead of as well as the eastern border. Yeah. And so the likelihood is that the Pakistanis will try to up the ante in Kashmir again, just to draw the Indians' attention away from Afghanistan, rather.
And also, wouldn't that also force them into tacitly supporting the Taliban, because that is their hedge in a way? I mean, didn't
absolutely, sir.
You know,
the Indian Karzai relationship that we are pushing forward is going to ensure that the Pakistanis see it in their national interest to support al-Qaeda and the Taliban in an effort to destroy Karzai's government. As night follows day, you know, sometimes we forget that every country in the world has geopolitical interests, and none of them are identical to ours. And the stronger the Indian-Afghan relationship, the more certain the Pakistanis will support the resurgence of the Taliban and al-Qaeda.
And the Pashtuns are the means by which they get back into the game.
Yes, sir, that's exactly right. And, of course, you know, there's no border between the two countries. And there's a lot of fence mending to do with the Pashtuns, because As I said, Musharraf sent the conventional military into their area and caused quite a bit of rancor. So in order to keep them on the side of Pakistan, they're going to have to point them in another direction, and that's going to be a Karzai's government.
Because it's been, I think, known for some time that most of the government, a lot of these ministers are married to Indians. They have second homes in India. I'm just astounded that we would be at a strategic level encouraging a strategic policy that is so manifestly counterintuitive and counterproductive.
Well, Mr. Masters, you can never underestimate the ignorance of American politicians about the outside world. I would entirely agree with you, but we're actually replicating what we did after the Soviets left. We're trying to install in Afghanistan a government that's non-tribal, semi-secular, friendly with Russia, India, and Iran, and dominated by the northern minorities of Afghanistan. We tried to do it in 91 and 92, and it didn't work. And the same guy who did it then, Mr. Khalilzad, is tried to do it again before he got moved over to Iraq.
Well, it would seem then that you could almost extrapolate from what you're saying, Mike Shoya, that the resurgence of the Taliban may well be tied to Pakistan's ambivalence.
Well, certainly part of it is, sir. And another part of it is... we didn't do an especially large amount of damage to either al-Qaeda and the Taliban in 2001 because we weren't ready to strike them right away. By the time we got to Afghanistan, most of them had gone to ground. I think the estimate that the Army War College made was that about 40,000 Taliban people went home with their weapons to kind of fight another day. And the resurgence, I think, would have happened one way or another, because al-Qaeda and the Taliban would have still drawn great support from the Persian Gulf countries. But because of the way Karzai's government is intimate with Pakistan's dire enemies, I think you're right. I think the Pakistanis simply will turn a blind eye to the activities of al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Pakistan as a base for operations in Afghanistan.
So the notion that there's something that our side could do vis-a-vis working out an arrangement with the Pakistani officer corps and Musharraf to take care of bin Laden and Zawahiri, that doesn't seem likely in the context of what we're talking about. It seems to be the problem is heading in the opposite direction.
Yes, sir. It's absolutely headed in the opposite direction, and it's only because no one in the American side who's responsible for decision-making bothered to read any history. The Karzai's government is just exactly what Pakistan has long feared, a government friendly to powers who would love to be able to conduct operations from Afghanistan into the western areas of Pakistan, primarily the Indians, but also the Iranians. So, yes, we just kind of bowled ahead in our desire to install a government that resembled us. And we kind of ignored 2,000 years of Afghan history and more than half a century of Pakistani history.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Michael Shoya, formerly known as Anonymous. He's a 22-year CIA veteran and analyst. He was the chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit from 1995 to 1999, the author under the title Anonymous of Imperial Hubris, and before that, Through Our Enemy's Eyes, which is being republished in January, and much of what was written and cut out of the early version has been added, so it's a double tome, if you will. Let's turn then, Mike, to Saudi Arabia, our other strategic pillar. It seems to me that our strategic blindness, and we just talked about our strategic blindness in terms of Pakistan and Afghanistan, our strategic blindness in going into Iraq, when people like Brent Scowcroft and others warned against it, seems to have had the net effect of handing over the most valuable part of Iraq, that is the oil the Shiite area where most of the oil is seems to be, if not controlled by Iran, but certainly dominated by Iran, the new government there. The spiritual leader is, after all, an Iranian. The Kurds seem to want to sit it out. They've got some oil in Kirkuk. The Sunni have a dry hole there in the middle of the country that they previously brutally dominated, and that's where the insurgency is. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that what we've got here, what President Bush has blundered into here, is a surrogate war where the Iranians are on one side and the Saudis, the Jordanians and the Gulf are supporting the Sunni. And is that where we stand?
Oh, I think that's exactly right. Our government, and it's both parties. It's, you know, the Republicans are in power, but the Democrats approach the problem in the same way. Both in Afghanistan and Iraq, they speak and think and talk as if both countries were hermetically sealed. And, of course, whether we leave Iraq or not, we've helped to create kind of a regional cockpit. Certainly the Gulf states and Egypt and Jordan will not tolerate a Shia-dominated
Iraq.
The Iranians will not, of course, tolerate a Sunni-dominated Iraq. And who knows what the Turks and the Kurds are going to do over the long term. But I think the point is that if we left tomorrow, there would be an Afghanistan-like situation in Iraq simply because there'd be a Shia-Sunni conflict for all that wealth and based on the long schism between Shias and Sunnis. You're exactly right. What we've ensured is an ongoing regional conflict in a previously semi-stable area.
And obviously, the correlation of forces in terms of the civil war, which is in a nascent state now, and at some point or other could blow up into a full scale civil war. Given the correlation of forces, I guess you could assume that in the long run, the Shia would win the civil war, and the defeated Sunni insurgents would then retreat into Jordan and into Saudi Arabia and destabilize those fragile countries.
I think that's exactly right, sir. Is the one thing that amazes me is that the American politicians, again, in a bipartisan way, kind of crow about how clever they've been to go to Iraq and attract, use it as a magnet, so we can fight them there instead of in America. That kind of ignores the fact there's 1.3 billion Muslims and there's plenty of people to fight in all places. But again, from the enemy's perspective, from Al-Qaeda and its allies, what a destabilized Iraq does is not only give them a chance to go there and kill Americans, but for the first time to have a contiguous area from which they can reach into Jordan, Syria, and ultimately through those countries into Israel and Lebanon. So it's going to be a strategic corridor for Al-Qaeda and its allies, and I have not seen any of our politicians refer to that fact.
So, in other words, the neoconservatives, who were the intellectual architects of this strategic blunder in Iraq, they may end up harming Israel.
Oh, without a question, sir. They've certainly made Israel a less viable polity over the next 10 or 20 years than it was before. Absolutely the case.
So in other words, Israel is going to have a roiling Arab insurgency on their West Bank.
Well, certainly it's, you know, who knows how quickly it's going to act or move through, but what I think in the near term you're going to see is increased problems for Abdullah in Jordan, which is a very divided, tenuous society at the best of times. And once Jordan becomes less stable, clearly it is a basis to get at the Israelis.
Well, I was hoping to talk about 9/11, but I think this is a much more valuable discussion. Just if I can just go back to the, since it's the fourth anniversary of 9/11, What's your feelings about accountability? Because we've had this hurricane down there in in the South, in New Orleans, and nobody seems to want to be accountable. They talk about the blame game, and there's obviously a lot of blame to go around, but again, it seems that there's a lack of accountability. I've never felt that there was any real accountability to for the obvious lapses prior to 9/11. I know that the 9/11 Commission looked into it, but essentially everybody's been promoted. Condoleezza Rice is now the Secretary of State.
That's exactly right, and that's the reason I resigned from the agency, because I have no axe to grind against CIA, but the 9/11 Commission completely whitewashed the 9/11 problem by failing to find anyone responsible for anything. When you look at Kane and Hamilton and the rest of their colleagues, it looks like they sent political hacks to protect political hacks. And I think that the American people need to realize that, and perhaps I have been hoping, at least, that the aftermath of Katrina, once we have helped the people who need to be helped, people will begin to point fingers. No one wants to point fingers to gratuitously cut someone's head off. But we've become a society, at least at the federal level, that we're absolutely unaccountable. And, you know, as you said, Mr. Tenet got the Medal of Freedom. Ms. Rice got promoted. Richard Clark and Sandy Berger, who had more chances than President Bush ever had to kill Osama bin Laden, are now multimillionaires in the consulting field. It's absurd. And I hope that maybe Katrina and its aftermath will make the American people demand some sort of accountability.
Well, in terms of George Tenet, recently, and you were in the CNN special that they did about the intelligence meltdown, they made a pretty clear case that, in fact, George Tenet snookered Secretary of State Powell. Powell was dubious about the intelligence that he was provided from this source called Curveball, which in itself should have sent up some flags. I think Larry Johnson said something. Maybe they should have named Curveball lying something or other. I can't even repeat it on the air. The piece made it pretty clear that and Colonel Wilkinson, who's the was a chief aide to Powell, was an on-camera source on this, that essentially Powell sat with Tenet for several days going over this menu of alleged intelligence about Iraq's capabilities, and eventually agreed. But on every level, Tenet said it's good.
Yeah.
And you get the impression that Tenet was actually, you know, a surrogate for the White House on this, that Powell got hung out to dry both by President Bush and you know, in a Shakespearean way, Tenet was the Brutus.
Well, I'll tell you, Secretary Powell not only got hung out to dry, but certainly the CIA got hung out to dry by Mr. Tenet, because there is no CIA officer who would ever have said this is a slam dunk, or would have described to Secretary Powell intelligence derived from Iraqi opposition groups as certain. And I know just from my own little slice of the pie, I was in charge of researching back 10 years for any connections between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein after Doug Feith at DOD had published a paper that said it was a host country surrogate relationship. We went back through 20,000 documents, about 75,000 pages of material, and found absolutely no connection. So as a group, we were pretty surprised to hear Secretary Powell say to the UN that there was a connection between Saddam and Osama.
Well, it seems that the Select Intelligence Committee is really not doing its job, because the Ralph Silverman report looked into Curveball, but they didn't look into the Niger forgeries, which are the basis of why Ambassador Wilson was sent to Niger, and then, of course, we know what happened there with his wife, the CIA officer being outed, and now there's a special prosecutor. But nobody, either in the government or in the press for that matter, with the exception of me, I have to toot my own horn here, have bothered to look into that, you know. And it seems to me that the evidence now indicates that the Niger documents were forged here in the United States by this group of neocons.
Well, you know, I don't know the answer to that one, but I don't put much past them. I think the problem we need is a gallows, basically, for federal officials who, not so much for what they do. I think we should be very forgiving about people who try to protect America and make mistakes, but more for people who don't do what they know needs to be done. And I think our government is rife with those people. I think it's why 9/11 happened. And I think we're going to find out that much of what happened to Katrina is the same thing. You know, I think in the long run, the neocons often remind me of the revolutionaries in France.
They're the Jacobins, you mean?
Ideologues, and they're willing to use violence and terror to accomplish their goals. In that sense, they're very un-American. They're not at all like the revolutionaries of America, who were very much realists and knew that human beings were not perfectible. You know, Wolfowitz is much closer to Robespierre than he is to John Adams.
Mm. But what about the idea that people like you and people in the Pentagon and in all of the services, they serve the United States, they don't serve the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, and it seems to me that the neocons, having captured this White House, have now politicized, and I mentioned earlier, Senator Pat Roberts on the Select Intelligence Committee is basically not doing his job. He's protecting the White House, not serving the people. So,
I think that's right. I think Senator Roberts, you know, when Robin Silverman issued their report, he said, now we know all we need to ever know about 9/11 in Iraq. Well, that's a lot of horse hockey, if you will. I think you're exactly right, sir. I think they've politicized the bureaucracy, and they're purging the bureaucracy of people who are concerned about the security of America. The associate or the number two in the Directorate of Operations the other day at CIA resigned. A very experienced officer who risked his life on many occasions for American security resigned and said, "I have no confidence in this leadership."
Meaning the new DCI, who's a politician?
Yes, that's right. I think he meant the Mr. Goss, and I think he also meant the direction that the agency's getting from the White House.
So it actually, the White House has actually captured the CIA now?
Certainly, it seems to me that way. I have to say I have not been in there since November, but it from what I hear and what the actions seem to be, it's very much an organization which is afraid to tell the truth.
So we're flying blind as a country, though, if the president doesn't get the truth.
Absolutely, sir. And we've been flying blind really for much of the past 15 years because we have never, the intelligence community has never been able to tell the truth to people in the White House or at the NSC because so many of the realities of the situation, such as the motivation of our enemy because of the police states we support in Egypt and in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in the Islamic world, are motivating them. There is absolutely no ability to talk about the problem Israel poses to the security of the United States. Really, for 15 years on the issue of Islamic extremism, the truth has been there for the taking, but there has been a very much a deaf ear at the senior-most levels of our government.
Well, just in closing, though, Mike Shore, if you, not that the government, our government has ever explained exactly why we went into Iraq, because they keep changing their narrative from WMD to we're bringing democracy, etc. But let's just take it at the surface. The idea was to secure and stabilize oil. That hasn't worked. To take the pressure off Israel. That hasn't worked. To bring democracy. That hasn't worked. To find weapons of mass destruction. Well, there weren't any. Again, you know, you're crying out for some kind of accountability here.
Oh, absolutely, sir. Without question, and I really don't know what it's going to take. You know, the joke was after we lost two embassies in East Africa and then almost lost the destroyer Cole, that we certainly said, you know, somebody's got to pay the price for this. And then came 9/11, and still no one has paid the price for it. And we're headed down a path that's going to be, you know, we're going to see tens of thousands of dead Americans, not from a natural disaster, but from a man-made attack. And maybe that's what it's going to take. It's a terrible thing to say, but we're certainly, as you say, we're flying blind at the moment.
But it seems to me, Mike, just in closing, that in effect, when President Bush, a couple of days after 9/11, declared the war on terror, it seems to me at that moment he lost it, because we have... it's no accident that Al Qaeda struck on the day of the G8 conference in London. I mean, obviously they're gate crashing the party. They're saying to the world, we're state actors just like the G8.
Absolutely.
And they seem to be able to jerk our chain at will, and we dignify them by sending the world's own lone superpower's military to take them on. Well, you know, President Bush has turned our military into a paper tiger in Iraq because he put them in a no-win situation.
That's absolutely right, sir. The neocons will be remembered, if for nothing else, than for ruining the U.S. military and bringing it back to the state it was in after Vietnam. Because you're exactly right. Anybody who thinks that the number of troops we sent to Iraq, whether you think we should have went at all, was sufficient to win, is just delusionary. There are a lot of, I don't know if they qualify for crimes, but a lot of knowing errors, willful errors, that need to be both uncovered and punished.
But in the long, just in the long and the short of it is, you've often said that we have a choice between war and endless war.
Yes, sir.
And our missteps seem to be guaranteeing endless war, and in fact, making a victory in the war on terror look less and less likely.
Oh, it's certainly less likely than it was 4 years ago. Yes, sir. As I've tried to argue, the use of the U.S. intelligence services and the military can hold the ring for a while, but as long as our policies toward the Islamic world remain unchanged, we're creating more enemies every day than certainly the American people can imagine. And until we debate in this country what our foreign policy should be in the best interests of the American people, we're headed toward that status of endless war, sir.
I thank you for joining us in Los Angeles, Michael Scioia.
It's always a pleasure, sir. It's an honor to be with you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Michael Scioia, who was formerly known as Anonymous. He was a 22-year veteran analyst at the CIA, where he headed up the CIA's... he was the chief of the Bin Laden unit from 1995 to 1999. He's the author of Imperial Hubris and Through Our Enemy's Eyes, which is being republished in January. I'm now speaking with Mark Danner, who is a professor of journalism and politics at the University of California, Berkeley, and Bard College. He's the author most recently of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. And he has the cover article in today's Sunday's New York Times Magazine, Taking Stock of the Forever War. And Mark, just to touch on what Mike Scioia was saying, do you think that we lost the war on terror the moment that President Bush declared it? I mean, obviously, President Bush declared the war on terror in part, or perhaps largely, for domestic political reasons, because it made him a wartime president. He was able to win back the Senate and increase the Republican lead in the House, put the Democrats on the defensive, and particularly John Kerry, and get reelected for a four-year term as a wartime president. Is the country paying a price for President Bush's domestic success?
Well, I think what you just said is true. I also think, though, that the Bush administration framed the terms of the war on terror in terms that are quite familiar in U.S. history, especially recent history, the Cold War history. That is, dividing the world into two, into good and evil, essentially making the terrorists this enormous force similar to the communists, who are kind of our evil twin, And they must be extirpated. You know, we have to join this war and eliminate evil, as the president said, rid the world of evil. So he put it in very broad ideological terms. I think you're right that this was beneficial to him politically at home, but I don't think that's necessarily the single reason why it was put in those terms. I think that kind of rhetoric falls very easily on American ears. It's very good for rallying the people. It's very simple terms, good, evil, America, the agent of good in the world. This is an American idea that goes back four centuries, you know, the notion of the city on the hill and so on. So, I mean, this is rhetoric that was kind of very near to hand. The problem to me is that they followed this rhetoric and let it influence the kind of policies they adopted, notably the decision to invade and occupy Iraq. And the notion, I mean, I think there are a lot of reasons and motivations for that war, but one of them had to do with democratization, certainly, and this notion of ending terror by democratizing the Arab world, the Islamic world. I mean, this was an idea on the part of Wolfowitz and several other people, and, you know, it's this kind of grand metaphysical gamble that it was almost breathtaking in its ambition, and it didn't work, and the opposite has happened. We've begun and are now bogged down in this endless counterinsurgency war in Iraq, which has really become the new Afghanistan. That is, Afghanistan in the 80s was really the country that built al-Qaeda. It gave images of, you know, the Mujahideen, the holy warriors, fighting a superpower and defeating a superpower. And Iraq is doing the same for the Islamic movement today. It's supplying endless images of the United States raiding Muslim homes, killing Muslims, occupying, obviously, a Muslim country. And there is no victory in sight. There won't be a victory in this war. So it's very beneficial, I think, for bin Laden and for other Islamists. It's kind of a trap that is paying and keeps on paying the Islamist political cause. I don't really think all of this originated in simple kind of political motives. It obviously did pay off for them politically in the midterm elections of 2002 and the presidential election of 2004, but I think there were other motives as well, in my opinion.
Well, but Mark Danner, I think the verdict pretty much is that the President Bush's impetuous and immature use of American power has undermined our strength, and it, instead of demonstrating overwhelming superiority and invincibility of the U.S. military, they've already turned it around and resulted in a major strategic failure, because rather than intimidating others with our awesome technology and firepower, we've in fact done the opposite. We've dramatically illustrated the severe limitations of military force as a means of defeating ideas and passions, and have given other potential enemies of the United States all over the world another free object lesson in how small and weak forces can torment, frustrate, and defeat a much more powerful antagonist. In other words, we have turned the rules of asymmetrical warfare against us.
Yes, well, I certainly agree with that one of the remarkable things, I mean, if you think what would Osama bin Laden have said 4 years ago today if he had to predict what the situation would be 4 years into the future. And the notion, I think, that, well, the United States would be bogged down in an endless counterinsurgency war, the U.S. military would be stretched to the breaking point, you know, recruitment down, the active combat forces, already most of them having served two tours of duty in Iraq, the reserves in meltdown, as General Barry McCaffrey put it a couple of weeks ago before Congress, the American public divided and increasingly upset and skeptical about the value of this war, support for the president below 40% approval rating, the allies' relationship with the U.S. at a low point. I mean, all of these things, if you had set this out as a scenario for bin Laden 4 years ago and said this would be the future 4 years from this day, I think he would have been very happy, but perhaps might have thought that was an overly optimistic scenario for him. And, you know, I agree with you that the one remarkable thing about the last 4 years and where we stand now is that the administration, by the decisions it's made, and notably the Iraq occupation, has indeed showed the limits of American power. And, you know, one of the rules of leadership, supposedly, is you never issue an order that will not be followed, because that shows the limits of authority. And there is a sense in which the United States and the Bush administration did precisely that thing you're never supposed to do. We engaged in a asymmetric conflict, as you say, which is eventuated by showing the limits of American power, showing very vividly the limits of those powers in Iraq. And if Iraq was supposed to be a demonstration war that was supposed to start a domino effect throughout the Middle East of democratization, at the moment, Iraq is looking very much like a failed state. I mean, I argue this in this New York Times Sunday Magazine piece today, that you know, domino effects can go both ways. Dominoes can fall in both directions. If, on the one hand, this was supposed to cause, you know, democratization in neighboring states, we could be seeing the beginning of the opposite fall of dominoes. That is, a failed state in Iraq, which will cause increasing destabilization in neighboring states as time goes on. Zarqawi, who is the leader of al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, has stated very forthrightly that what he is interested in is starting a civil war in Iraq that will become a regional civil war, a Shia-Sunni civil war throughout the region. And, you know, you're seeing signs of that in Iraq itself. So not only have we shown the limitations of American power, as you point out, but the consequences of that demonstration are not yet in view. I mean, it could get much worse.
And Mark Denner, in your article in today's New York Times Magazine, Taking Stock of the Forever War, you point out that 4 years from using the analogy with Pearl Harbor, 4 years after Pearl Harbor, the United States had defeated Germany and Japan and dominated the world. 4 years after 9/11, where do you put us?
Well, we're certainly nowhere near where we were 4 years after Pearl Harbor. That's certainly true. I am not, you know, the Times headlined the piece, "Is He Winning?" Over a picture of Osama bin Laden on the cover of the Sunday magazine. I don't know whether you could say bin Laden is winning, strictly speaking. There's an old chestnut that goes, in a guerrilla war, the government loses by not winning. The guerrilla wins by not losing. And it's certainly the case, if this is your definition of victory, bin Laden is winning, because it's clear that his movement has not lost, that he obviously still exists. His top lieutenant and bin Laden himself issue their video and audio tapes on a regular basis. They are safe wherever they are. And though many of the operational cadre directly beneath him have been captured or killed, the organization still does exist in some form. And meanwhile, you have a lot of what I call viral al-Qaeda or al-Qaedism, that al-Qaeda has really become al-Qaedism. It's gone from being this terrorist group, this loosely connected network, to becoming a political movement, and in which his main role is a propagandistic and ideological one. He issues statements by audio and videotape, and you have many of his followers who are not necessarily directly connected to him in any way, which is one of the changes over the last 4 years, that many of the more prominent attacks, Casablanca attacks, for example, the Madrid attacks, perhaps the London attacks, although that's disputed, were undertaken by people who'd never been to Afghanistan, who certainly hadn't been to training camps, but were followers of his nonetheless, and learned their tradecraft really from the internet. You know, used very basic weapons. The bombs in London, for example, were just made from very basic chemicals. You know, they were quite simple bombs, homemade devices. Nothing sophisticated about them at all. So you're seeing, I think, 4 years after 9/11, the evolution of al-Qaeda from a tightly directed organization that was also a network of various smaller organizations, obviously, around the world, into a much broader political movement, some of whose followers have no direct contact whatever with the leader. They might listen to his tapes and watch him on video, but they do not necessarily directly plan operations with his knowledge. But the internet and other technological innovations have made it possible to mount these kind of attacks without any real training at all. So in the context of your question, which is, you know, who's winning, I think that development is extremely serious and dangerous for the United States, because these sorts of attacks are extremely difficult to stop, prevent, because in many cases the people who mount them are not on the radar screens of the intelligence services. I mean, they've not been abroad for training. They don't necessarily have any kind of footprint that the intelligence services can follow or look or trace. So this, from the point of view of the United States, I think is a very ominous development. And one of the things feeding that certainly is, again, the propaganda effect, the sort of nefarious propaganda effect of the Iraq War, of the never-ending war, the forever war, as I call it in the New York Times magazine today.
Well, Mark Danner, I think that Mark Shaw and I were talking about it earlier. You could almost take it further that Iraq is the gift that keeps on giving for bin Laden. If you follow this strategic blunder that President Bush, the abyss that he tipped this country over into, means that, you know, already Iran is winning, at least has won the oil-rich Shiite part. The Sunni, they've got nothing, and the Kurds are sitting it out, and eventually the correlation of forces are such that the Shiite will win the civil war, the Sunni will then retreat into Jordan and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, where they will destabilize those fragile regimes, and bin Laden will end up on the throne in Saudi Arabia. So it's a perfect storm of incompetence, if you follow the logic of... or the potential logic of where we're heading.
Well, I think that certainly is one scenario. I mean, to me, that's very... I wouldn't necessarily say that is the way things have to evolve, but I agree that it's quite possible they could move in that direction.
Well, don't you think in 2006 that the Republicans are already leaning on President Bush, saying, you know, we're going to get whipped in 06, we've got to get out of Iraq. They'll obviously put contractors in to replace the soldiers, but it just seems like a fiction. And the fact our military are not doing anything but protect themselves. The only beneficiaries of this misadventure are the contractors, who are making out like bandits.
I think I agree with you that there is a dynamic already in place that will lead to the beginning of withdrawals of American troops probably sometime next year. I think that's so, not only because of the 06 elections, which I agree with you, the Republican candidates in particular are very frightened of running with this war over their heads, and with a very shackled to a very unpopular president whose numbers are now below 40%, which is Clinton basically never got that low. You know, these are very low numbers, and the press, I think, hasn't yet taken account of how unpopular President Bush has become. The second point, or the second factor leading to the beginning of these withdrawals, is simply that the military is running out of troops. You're in a situation now where a majority of the active combat forces in the Army have served two tours in Iraq, and by the end of 06, almost everyone will have served two tours. That is, you know, they have a rule within the Army that you're not supposed to send somebody back for a third tour in a combat zone. I mean, they may break that rule, but that at the moment is the rule. So there's a dynamic within the military that would lead, you know, that is pushing essentially for a drawdown of troops. And General Casey in Iraq acknowledged that a few weeks ago when Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, was there visiting him. So I think you're right. I think there will be the beginning of a withdrawal. I don't know how that they can really replace troops with contractors. I mean, military contractors are not combat soldiers, and they can't do the things that combat soldiers do. So I don't know. You know, the policy now is that they're supposed to be replacing these American troops with the growing Iraqi army,
which is a Shia and Kurd army, not a.
Well, exactly. I was going to say that one of the problems, of course, of that is that supposedly one of our interests there is to prevent an unfolding civil war. The problem is that you have an army that is essentially sectarian, that's Shia and Kurd. You have many of the local police forces, particularly in the Sunni, so-called Sunni Triangle area, are largely Sunni, and of course the insurgency is Sunni, and so you have the dynamic built in there right now for a civil war that Zarqawi, as I mentioned, is openly saying he is trying to spark. So none of that is very encouraging for an end to the war. In fact, it suggests that it will get worse. And then you have the regional dynamics, which is many of the Islamists who are coming over the border are Saudis, Kuwaitis, Syrians, Jordanians. You know, they're from the Sunni regimes in the area. And you have many, of course, a strong Iran element in the south. A lot of Iranian intelligence assets are in the south now. So all of this is taking on a rather ominous regional profile that the dynamics suggest will get worse. It's hard to predict these things, but it's certainly hard to see how it is going to improve. And one of the things I argue in the New York Times Magazine piece is that U.S. power in Iraq basically is waning as we speak. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, the president called up Abdul al-Hakim, the head of Siri. This was when the constitutional negotiations were reaching a climax. The president called him personally and said, you know, please, we need some concessions here to get the Sunnis on board. And al-Hakim basically said, gee, very nice of you to call, Mr. President, but sorry, there's nothing I can do. I mean, he really just turned him down flat, which is remarkable when you consider that supposedly the U.S. is the critical power in the country. In fact, that isn't the situation now. U.S. power, as I argue, is waning, and our American ability to control events there is certainly going away as we speak.
Well, certainly Tehran has more influence than Washington does, probably. But
I think that's true. I mean, it depends on what exactly we're talking about. But it's true that, you know, Tehran a few months ago negotiated a deal with the current government, which of course is a Shia-controlled government, with the two critical parties, Skiri Party and the al-Dawa Party, were both nurtured in Iran over the last 20 years.
The Badr Brigade, which was their surrogate army of Iraqis, fought for the Iranians. And
yes.
little wonder the Sunni are better about that. Let me just, in closing, though, Mark Danner, since you're the author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror, given what we're talking about, this extraordinary strategic blunder following 9/11, getting into Iraq and the extent to which it's a vortex that's sucking the life and energy and treasure of this country into nowheresville, on top of that, it seems that the torture thing is just like the most gratuitous, stupid thing that could be imagined. The disrepute it's done this country, on the top of everything else.
Yes, well, it's you know, I like to say that if you look at that picture of Hooded Man, or the other famous picture of Leashed Man, with Lindy England holding the leash around the neck of the naked Iraqi lying on the floor in pain, it's as if Osama bin Laden had come to Madison Avenue and said, can I have I need a poster designed that would, you know, absolutely crystallize my message to the Islamic world. I want a poster that will actually say, that will show, depict America repressing Muslims, America torturing Muslims, America unmanning Muslims. That's what I want to show depicted. And it's as if those images, which of course are now ubiquitous in the Middle East, and you see them on murals in Iraq and elsewhere in the Middle East, those images have been so powerful in conveying his message, which is the United States repressing Muslims. And they are images that the United States supplied to him, essentially. And, you know, it's the problem here, or the damage, is twofold. The first is the propaganda damage, which you very rightly point to. The second is the fact that torture is a strategy of weakness. I mean, it's a strategy that shows that the U.S., because of its political weakness in Iraq, is unable to get the information it needs, the intelligence it needs, to fight the insurgency effectively, and so must resort to torture to get that information, even though there's no evidence, of course, any of this was successful. But it's a strategy that shows that the political strength you need to succeed in fighting an insurgency, which is having enough political credibility that people will come up to you and give you intelligence and say, look, the insurgents are in that house down the street, and so on. Because after all, it's not as if these guys are hiding in the jungle or the mountains. I mean, they're right there in the cities of Iraq. That political strength that you need to be effective, the U.S. wholly lacks. And the resort to torture is a clear indication of the political weakness of the American effort there, which at the end of the day is the most ominous sign of all, I think.
Well, just in closing then, obviously, had President Bush not been a cowboy and not acted unilaterally, and had he, with the funeral pyre still in the air over New York, convened the rest of the world to treat a global problem rather than a unilateral problem, we would have probably been in a different landscape today. But I don't see how we can retreat from this short of regime change in this country. I mean, is there a way to get the world in to help us out?
I have to admit, Ian, that I share your pessimism on this point, I'm afraid. Mm. I wrote in the New York Times Magazine piece that the only way out of Iraq at the moment, it seems to me, without a kind of cascading series of very damaging consequences, would be to try to arrange a regional solution in some way, to negotiate something with neighboring countries, all of whom have an interest in Iraq not splitting apart into a bloody mess.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, and I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Mark Danner.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking then with Mark Danner, who's a professor of journalism and politics at the University of California and Bard College. He's the author of this article and the lead article, Taking Stock of the Forever War, in the New York Times Magazine. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Jazz Shepherd, the engineer, Rusty Wing, and Carol Coote, the assistant producer.